Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be spending most of this hour with a familiar friend to the morning show, Dan Joyce, Executive Director of the Kenosha Public Museum, and with, let's say, a brand new friend of the morning show and brand new to at least most of you. His name is Richard Harris, and he is an art collector with an extraordinary personal collection of artworks that are related in one way or another to the theme of death. And he has kindly lent to the Kenosha Public Museum just under 100 pieces, I believe, from that collection for public viewing. And this exhibit has already been on display, and it remains on display only till the 25th of February. So the clock is ticking in terms of the opportunity for you to experience this yourself. And I'm really glad that we can have Dan Joyce and Richard Harris with us for this first part of the morning show to talk about this collection and what it represents and what people will experience if you come to the museum to see it for yourself. Dan Joyce, Richard Harris, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Good morning, Greg.
Good to have both of you here. So, Dan, I think we should start with you and kind of get the background on this connection between the two of you and whatever transaction took place that allows this collection of art to be at the museum, and whether or not such occurrences or transactions are commonplace in the world of museums.
Well, one of the things that we do in museums is we try to plan well ahead for exhibits. 2-3 years out even. But we always remain flexible because opportunities come up. And that's what happened here is we had a just happenstance opportunity. Mr. Harris was doing an exhibit in Waukegan at a local art gallery and had talked to the mayor. And the mayor said that Mr. Harris should talk to the Kenosha mayor because we have great museums up here as well. And that kind of started the chain reaction. The mayor called me. I called Mr. Harris. We started to talk and thought, wow, it would be wonderful to be able to exhibit some of Mr. Harris's wonderful collection, not only of death theme materials, so to speak, but also materials that span several thousand years from ancient art to contemporary art. And Mr. Harris was wonderful in offering us the opportunity to show a small part of a very large collection. And we took him up on it, and we thought, wow, we have to do this right away. Right. So we made space in our schedule, and we turned it around very, very quickly.
There you go.
And so, got it going. So it was a great opportunity for us to show some amazing artwork.
Thank you, Dan. Yeah.
So King Tut's tomb got postponed for a couple of years.
Exactly. So, King Tut is nothing compared to that.
That's right. Well, I'm starting to wonder because, I mean, it does sound indeed like a remarkable collection as spanning centuries versus King Tut's remains. That would be exciting, too, but represents a moment in history. And this represents, of course, something quite different. Absolutely. We should say, I don't think I mentioned it in the introduction, that this exhibit is called Memento Mori, The Art of Death, and Memento Mori, that would be Latin or Italian for a reminder of death, and it's certainly an intriguing title. So, Mr. Harris, again, we welcome you, and I guess what would really be interesting, first of all, is to know a little bit about your life as an art collector. When and how did that begin? Is this something that's maybe part of your family's lineage or in some other way? How did this become such an important part of your life?
Thank you, Greg. No, it wasn't. In fact, I keep talking the fact that as a young man, I didn't collect marbles and I didn't collect baseball cards and I didn't do anything of that sort. I after I graduated college with a minor in art history, and never thinking that one could make a living out of art in any way, shape, or form, I just floundered for several years between those years, and finally got into the art field in a circuitous way, selling art reproductions as a traveling salesman. And then after this, a couple of German brothers found me and discovered Richard Harris as a good salesman and maybe somebody who might follow in their footsteps in their business. They were getting on in age, and I was a young man, about 30, 32 years of age. And they offered me this job of selling antique prints, which was much more interesting and much more fun and academically more interesting as a fact of selling reproductions where you'd sell the same print over and over and over again to different furniture stores and interior designers. And these antique prints were basically natural history, birds and botanicals and shells and animals and some architectural things as well as decorative things to the high-end interior design trade. And it was a wonderful career. And after a little while, briefly, I'd only worked for them about a half a year when I'd asked them what my future was with them in the company. And they said, oh, well, Richard, in 10 years or more, you can start getting some equity and start being a part of the financial part of the business. And I came home, and we just married and moved to Chicago, and I said to my wife, 10 years, being 30 years old, it seemed like an eternity. And so I thought, well, I think this looked interesting enough as a career of selling for someone else. And I thought maybe somehow I could do this on my own in some fashion or another. So I gave my notice and started off in the idea of being Richard Harris Incorporated, who sold antique prints to the same clients that I'd sold for the brothers in a brief period of time with them. I don't know how far you want me to go with this as far as the trip of what my journey came to be. I sold some gifts that I'd gotten and monies that I'd accumulated in over the years, bar mitzvah money and other things as well, and went to Europe, went to London. We had lived in an apartment in Evanston, and I went to the Evanston Library to see where I could find inventory. I didn't know how they bought and where they bought, the brothers, that is. So that was part of my search. And I went through, and there was Charing Cross Road was a primary street in London that seemed to have prints and books and things of some nature that sort of sounded a likely place to begin. We came to London. I dropped my wife off at the hotel, jet lag notwithstanding. I went to Charing Cross Road and going up and down the street. And unfortunately for my business sake, they were all modern, and most of them were modern bookstores and most modern print stores. And I thought, my gosh, what had I done? I'd left a good paying job. I'd left a career with these two gentlemen, and I have all this money in my pocket and no place to spend it. And I thought, my goodness, shame on you, Richard. I came back to the hotel almost crying like a baby and wondering what in the world I'd accomplished or done with my career or my thoughts of a future career. And my wife said, tomorrow's another day, Richard. Don't worry, it'll all work out. Wise woman. We went to bed, got up the next morning, traipsed around London, found one dealer who was very accommodating, bought some product from him. He told me about some other people, and I went to visit with them and bought some more product. And the business started and grew. So again, just as the introduction, the idea of collecting, I love art as I love music, classical music as well. And the art part of it, I thought, well, there's some things. These books were interesting, and these prints were interesting, and I loved Rembrandt, and I loved Picasso, and I thought, my goodness, when I had extra monies after the business had started, I had some additional funds that I felt that might be interesting to dabble in the collecting in a collecting fashion. And so it began. I started buying inadvertently natural history books. I mean, I would buy prints, loose prints, for my business sake and to sell. And occasionally I would buy a wonderful book that was illustrated. These were all antiquarian books. And that turned out to be, in 35 years afterwards, a collection of 250 of some of the most important antiquarian natural history books that were ever produced. And so that started one little part of the collecting aspect of it. And I guess I got the idea of collecting kind of grew on me. Mm. And I was walking at the end of a day in London on one of my buying trips to London early on, and I met a young man who was selling Rembrandt prints. I love Rembrandt as an artist, as a great artist that he was. And it was a little pop-up gallery that he had just on for a couple of weeks to introduce himself to the collectors who would be interested in Rembrandt. Talking with him for a little while, I bought three of his prints. And that started the print collection of Rembrandt and became Picasso and later Matisse. That collection, in the 35 or 40 years afterwards, I sold at Maastricht, which is a great art fair. It's one of the greatest and most important art fairs in the world, during 2000 and 2001, very successfully. It turned out that it was 85 prints and some of the most valuable and most important prints that ever were made in the history of printmaking, as a matter of fact. And I sold the book collection about the same time through auctions. With these resources from these two sales, I decided to venture out and to see what Richard Harris could be as a collector through his own eyes. The print collection was done while I was working, and so was the book collection, with the aid of dealers of prints, fine art prints. And I really kind of was the only, I would say yes or no, and depending on the price and what the image was like, and either bought it or didn't buy it. And the book collection was just, as I said, an inadvertent one, and it just kind of grew like Topsy. So when I sold these two collections, and I was at Maastricht, one of the dealers had a Memento Mori show, a little booth showing paintings and drawings and prints and photographs of death. And I'd never done a thematic collection ever before, and so that piqued my curiosity. I was traveling back and went to New York on my way back to Chicago and was interviewing a curator and was wondering what kind of collection I could put together in regards to the subject of death. And she was very kind and very nice, and she said, well, Richard, we could put together 50 pieces of masterpieces of art regarding death, and I could do this with you and for you. The print collection that I'd already sold and bought was bought through dealers, and I thought, well, that was fine. I really wanted to know what kind of an eye Richard Harris had and what kind of a way of buying and finding and creating something on my own. So that started the death collection, and I graciously said thank you to the lady. And I didn't want my collection to be a checkbook collection that her 50 masterpieces would have become, as the print collection was a checkbook. I mean, I wrote the checks on things that other people had found for me, and the idea of finding on my own and developing a program and a collection that was through my eyes was intriguing, and 20 years later, it became what it is now, a collection of over 3,000 objects.
And that this is a collection of 3,000 just in this Memento Mori?
No, it's the collection can be divided into two major portions. The one that is at the Kenosha Museum, Public Museum, is the part I called the Cultures of Death. And it represents death as it's been represented by the European world, the Asian world, the primitive world, and that's one aspect of death. When I got into that further, I realized that death is bigger than that. And that started the what I call the war collection, or Death on Steroids, which is the war collection. And that's grown to include the Civil War, World War I, World War II, and Vietnam. The additional part of that, when I bought the Civil War, put together the Civil War collection, I realized that the African American, the reason why the Civil War historically was begun in the first place, was hardly represented, visually and graphically, in my collection of Civil War material, and so I started what turned out to be as large or larger than the Civil War collection, which I call the African American Experience, which starts at slavery, through the Ku Klux Klan and lynching, to the Civil Rights Movement, to Black Power, and finally to Black Lives Matter, and that's. Again, I think this is indicative of my own interest in social justice and the idea of what the world in this country has developed and it's still in an evolving situation with regard to the African American community, and the war collection is something I think that war is something that we as a society and as human beings in our world ought to. Not get into situations that war is the ultimate result of it. And so that my anti-war and my feelings in regards to social justice are very prominent in my thinking and obviously in the collections.
And of course, from the sounds of it, you were anxious for this collection to be a very personal one. And it sounds like it is that in many respects. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on The Morning Show with Dan Joyce, the Executive Director of the Kenosha Public Museum, and Richard Harris, who has made available to the Kenosha Public Museum some 90 pieces from his own personal collection of artworks from all around the world and spanning a number of centuries for a special exhibit called Memento Mori, The Art of Death. And this is... on display at the Kenosha Public Museum until the 25th of February. So you have yielded to the Kenosha Public Museum these precious pieces that you have assembled. I suppose when you're in the business that you are in, that isn't maybe the wrenching experience that it might be for somebody else, where somebody came to you, a private citizen, and said, can we please borrow your Rembrandt for a couple of months? I mean, you are, in a sense, in the business of brokering deals and sharing artwork and so on. Nevertheless, what does it feel like on kind of a personal level when pieces you have personally assembled are sort of allowed to go out into the world for a time?
Well, contrary to what your premise is, I don't buy and sell. I mean, I've not sold anything I've collected, as a matter of fact. And the idea of having it seen by other people in other communities throughout the world, I mean, there was an exhibition at the Cultural Center in Chicago that had 150,000 visitors that was very successful. And then part of that went to London at the Wellcome Collection, where 136,000 visitors, and they averaged 1,600 a day to attend their exhibition. There aren't major museums in this world that have 1,600 visitors a day coming to see what they're showing. No, so the idea of the collection, unfortunately, it's presently basically in storage in an art storage facility in Chicago, and in a couple of rooms in our house. And my wife's disgruntled attitude, I'm taking over the house, and she's not pleased about that. But it's in storage. And the idea of having it displayed in a wonderful museum as the Kenosha Public Museum is, and with the staff that Dan has working with him and for him, pleases me to an extraordinary extent. I really urge people in the community, in the area, and people listening to this program to come and see this wonderful show. The insulation of this show is probably the best insulation it's had ever. And that includes London and Chicago. So it really is beautifully done and beautifully shown. And I think is a worthwhile experience to the community and to the listening audience to visit and enjoy and appreciate.
Dan, I would be really interested to hear from you on the challenge of accomplishing what Mr. Harris was just talking about. That is, presenting a collection like this that is so varied in terms of a way that is cohesive and pleasing to the eye and sense of cohesiveness and so on. I mean, what kind of challenge does that represent?
It's an extreme challenge. It is difficult. I mean, one of the great things about the collection is that it spans so much time. The expanse of time is amazing. Several thousand years up to yesterday almost. Very contemporary art. To pull that together, we have one of the best exhibits people around. Rachel Cleese Anderson is our curator of exhibits. She has an eye. She's been doing exhibitry for 35 years in museums, and she knows how to hang it together. I couldn't do that, to tell you the truth. I can make an adequate show, but she does it so well. And she has a trained eye, and she knows enough art history to be able to put things together in an appropriate way. The other challenge that we had is that we did it very, very quickly. As I said, this was happenstance, and we squeezed it into a period of time in the exhibit gallery that we had open. And to do something that quickly and that that well.
I was going to say that well. Thank you.
It's really a tribute to our staff. We have an amazing professional staff that is extremely well experienced. I was telling Richard before, some of our staff have worked at the Field Museum, at the Museum of Science and Industry, the Smithsonian Institute. We have really, really good people.
No kidding.
And when they pull it together, they pull it together well.
Right. So in other words, it's important, in a sense, it's important not to just look at the picture, but look at the frame. I mean, in a sense, we are talking about the frame of this entire collection. And
absolutely.
In a way that really draws the eye and engages the mind. It sounds absolutely fascinating. We should talk about at least a small handful of especially distinctive, interesting pieces that are part of this. Maybe beginning at least briefly, I'm afraid, with what I assume is the oldest piece, which is the jade piece from China from many thousands of years ago. Just say a brief word about what this piece is.
Again, it's a jade carved skull that is 2,000 years old from China. It is the earliest piece in the collection. And again, the idea that cultures throughout the history of the world, for that matter, have in some way or another visually represented death as a fact of life. And the beauty of it is that there is this continuity. And each period, and I found it interesting that major artists throughout the history of the world of art have in some way or another touched on the iconography of death as a subject to depict. So, you know, as Dan said, it goes from 2,000 years, and I've got an Egyptian death mask that's a couple of thousand years old as well, to something that's been created, you know, as I said, yesterday or today. And that breadth of it and the idea of that the mediums that are represented from prints and drawings and photographs and fabrics and ephemera and installations, it is the variety of things as well that captures the eye of the viewer.
And it's not only the fine art pieces too. There are ethnographic materials in the collection from all sorts of different cultures that relate to mortality. There's also advertising art that relates to it. You know, it's not all fine art, but it really is a whole as a collection. It really is diverse, but it all holds together very nicely.
And again, that was the genesis of when I decided to collect, as opposed to a masterpiece collection, was the idea that the collection would be included in you know, ephemera, things that are, I mean, I've got postcards and little pieces that cost me $5 that in my mind are as important as the Rembrandt etching that I have included in the collection, or the Dura woodcut.
So it's also things that are, in a sense, the stuff of life, the stuff of everyday life that one way or another touch on touch on this theme. When I saw the name of the exhibit, one of the first things it intrigued me very much, and I'm very anxious to get there to see it myself. I kind of imagined that it would also be an experience that would be very dark and very bleak, you know, just because that's just sure. those are the kind of adjectives that immediately come to mind. Just hearing you describe the enormous scope and breadth and scope of this collection, it sounds like it actually probably is not that.
Exactly. And in fact, one of the reviewers of the collection, I've forgotten where, which city it was at, said, Richard, you're such a brilliant and optimistic person. How do you, the art is not indicative of that. And it hasn't got, it is wonderful art created by extraordinary artists, whether they're world famous as Dürer and Rembrandt are, or some artists that are regional artists or local artists, as a matter of fact. And it's, the quality is still there, and that's something that bothers me sometimes as well, that the fact that some wonderful local and regional artists don't get the recognition that they deserve, and I'm pleased to have represented in the collection works of this sort as well.
Mm. Dan, do you have a piece or two that are special favorites for you, or that you think are worth highlighting for our listeners?
I love Dürer. There are two Dürers in there, one woodcut and one engraving, that are just spectacular. And you know, when you see a piece hanging on the wall that dates from a few years after Columbus's voyage, that's pretty impressive by itself.
Yeah,
but then the subject matter as well,
and the art,
quality of the art,
the art is
amazing.
Extraordinary. Yes, it is.
You know, you were talking about the perhaps depressing or dark portion of this. I wouldn't call it uplifting, but it's an exhibit that is not depressing.
It's not.
Exhibit that really refreshes us in some way, because I think in our culture we avoid death in many ways.
Sure.
But it's there for all of us. It's also something that we're familiar with, even though we avoid it. Mm-hmm. So seeing these images really kind of reminds us of time and mortality, and mm-hmm. live your life to its fullest.
Sure.
You only got so much time.
Of course. Well, and I think a lot of people who have gone to see the new Pixar film called Coco, mm-hmm. which explores the way in which Mexican culture
yep.
approaches death in a way very different from ours. I think for a lot of people, that's been an extraordinarily eye-opening experience. I think we tend to think of death as this universal experience that is awaiting all of us, as you just said, and yet that doesn't mean that we all await it in the same way.
Right.
And it sounds like this collection is also a way to explore and indeed celebrate that. Memento Mori, A Reminder of Death, The Art of Death, is on display now at the Kenosha Public Museum, but only till the 25th of February. So it's important for any of you who are intrigued by what we've been talking about to make your plans now to visit the museum and see this. 90 pieces of art in all, spanning centuries, spanning hemispheres, a very broad-based and extraordinary collection. And what a treat to have it right here in Kenosha. Dan Joyce, the executive director, thank you for being here. And Richard Harris, thank you for being here. Thank you also for making a portion of your priceless art collection available to the public here in southeastern Wisconsin. We are grateful for that, and I'm very grateful to you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Thank you, Greg.
And for more information, you can also call the museum at 653-4140. The time is 8:39. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD, and part two is coming up in just a moment. In this portion of WGTD's morning show, we are going to be hearing the harrowing story of Kevin Hines, who has the distinction of being one of a very few people who have survived a suicide attempt off of the Golden Gate Bridge. He lived to tell the story in a very, very powerful memoir called Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. Kevin Hines has contended with mental illness for much of his life, but has come to terms with it in very inspiring fashion. And that is really the most important heart and soul of the matter. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with Kevin Hines for the next few minutes about his story. Kevin Hines, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg, very much. I appreciate it.
As you look back on your early life, when is it that the specter of mental illness first began to sort of rear its head? At what point did either you or the people that cared about you sense that something was amiss?
The main point when people sensed that something was wrong or off or imbalanced occurred at 17 and a half years of age after dealing with epilepsy since fourth grade and having one grand mal seizure. They took me off of my epileptic medication, which happened to also be specific medication for mood disorders and it was antidepressant as well. But the doctors at the time didn't know it had that secondary effect. And so when they took me off of this epileptic medication, and at the same time that my parents got divorced, I had a complete mental breakdown at 17 and a half in high school.
At that point in time, what were the resources open to you, and how open were people about something like mental illness? I mean, what were you able to do with this sobering reality at such a young age?
Well, I mean, I went to see a doctor, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, got on medication. I was encouraged to follow a treatment plan of things like exercise, proper diet, different therapies that were reputable and proven, education as to my disease. All of these things these tools were kind of given to me, but I didn't really follow them. So for the next 2 years, 17 and a half to 19, I was just going up and down in the constant throes of bipolar disorder, mania, and depression, along with hallucinations, both auditory and visual, terrible, awful paranoid periods of extreme paranoia. I was a mess. And my family, you know, this was their first experience having a significant loved one with severe mental illness or the potential for that. And they really didn't know what to do. You know, I was living with my father at the time, and his education about mental illness wasn't very vast, and he did the best he could. And so, you know, when I got to 19 years of age and it was spiraling out of control, the problem was that I kept it all inside. No one really knew the extent to which my psychosis was taking over my mind and, frankly, my body, because the brain is connected to everything below, and everything below is connected to the brain. And too often in this country and around the globe, we forget that the brain is just an organ, just like every other organ in the body. And when the brain gets diseased, you know, just like liver, lung, heart disease, the rest of you is going to be affected. But I kept the real devastation of this illness away from people. My family didn't know that I was experiencing hallucinations on a daily basis. My family didn't know that when my dad, you know, went to work, I would look in the mirror and talk to myself as if it was an entirely different person or more than one person. My family didn't know that when my dad was doing his work in his office, I was in my room pacing back and forth or in circles, talking to myself, hearing voices, seeing things, going up and down with mania and depression. And, you know, the mania was pretty clear, but what were they to do about that? That was the reality that they were faced with. And that, I think at that point, they did everything they could do with what they knew.
Was it a steady downward arc towards this moment a couple of years later when you, at the age of 19, found yourself standing on the Golden Gate Bridge attempting suicide? Or was there sort of a precipitous drop that triggered that move on your part?
In my case, I don't recall a particular trigger at that at that moment of despair where I told myself I had to die. I remember skyrocketing into mania and falling into depression every week or other week. And so my father would see me skyrocket. He'd try to help me contain myself. But as I said, he would always repeat this one saying. He would say, "Kevin, I'm a banker, not a psychologist." And quite frankly, Greg, my doctor at the time, the day before my attempt, which was really the day before, that was the day I said to myself, I have to die tomorrow. That was the day the quote-unquote decision was made. But I never really call it a decision because I call it a compulsion. I maintain that I never, Kevin Hines never wanted to die by suicide. I believed that I had no other option. And those are two very, very, very different things.
Right.
And so, my father's trying to help me out. He's saying, why don't you come to work with me today? Why don't we go to school? Why don't we go to the beach? We'll go to the movies. Just be with me today, Kevin. I'm worried about you. And then there's me lying through my teeth telling my dad I feel so much better and I'm in a calm state. I'm in a calm state because I believe the pain is finally going to stop. The talking in my head, the hallucinations, the paranoias, the depressions, it's finally going to be over. What I couldn't see was that if I died that day, I would have had a ripple effect on everyone in my life who loved me and everyone in my life who knew me and everyone they knew. If I died that day, my brother would grow up in, I'm sure, an angry state of being for the rest of his life, or my sister would be sad and shallow for the rest of hers, and my parents would be devastated until the end of time. I couldn't see that. That's why when people say suicidal people are so selfish, they have no idea how painful it is to live with this brain pain, this mental illness, as they call it, what I call really a brain disease. They have no idea how crippling it is for not just the brain, but the body. And so, I'm getting to that point. My family, my dad's trying to help me the best way he knows how, but he was on the phone with my doctor the night before. And that doctor said these words, "Pat," my dad's name is Patrick, said, "Pat, it's just another episode. He'll come out of it in a couple of days. Don't worry about a thing." And so what was my dad, the banker, going to do when the professional clinician doctor told him that everything was going to be fine? And so, going through all of that and coming out of it and surviving what I survived, I remember being in the hospital and having the chaplain come to me, and he didn't even know why I was in the hospital. He didn't even know. He didn't check the chart, which he usually did. And he comes in with his black robe and his white robe and his red rosary in one hand. And he looks at me, and he's like the epitome of St. Francis, but with no birds on his shoulders. And he looks at me, and he says, "Hey, kid, what are you in for?" And I kind of stopped for a minute. I said, I jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. And he said, "Oh, yeah, and I'm the Pope." He didn't believe me. He thought I was delusional, which, maybe I was because of all the morphine, but not about that, of course. And he came to my side. He prayed with me. And he said at the end of his prayer, "Kid, when you get better, you ought to talk about this." And I remember looking at him and saying, "About what to who?" And I had no idea what he meant. And I do know what he meant today. He meant that the power of the spoken word has the ability to do one of two things: hurt and damage, or help and heal. And the right words at the right time with the right message can save lives. That's what I found out. And this journey over the last 15 years has been amazing. I've gone from an attempter of an attempt that 0.002% of people survive from, to a life lived with great purpose, trying to help other people stay here. And I always maintain, when someone calls me or writes me or tells me or messages me online and says, "You saved my life," I maintain that I didn't do anything. All I did was share a message that you took to your heart, and you, the individual who is saying that I saved your life, you actually did the work, the mental health work, the brain health effort to save your own life. You just found the ability and the passion, the drive to say, "Yes, I can. I can stay here." And as I travel the world and talk to people, I realize something, especially in high schools and colleges. The most common thing I hear when I travel is this: Mr. Hines or Kevin, I have bipolar disorder, or I have schizophrenia, or I have anxiety disorder, or OCD, they say. And they say, but my family, my mom and dad don't believe it's real. And it's heartbreaking.
Wow.
It's heartbreaking to go into every community and hear almost the same thing, that wherever I go, people aren't being listened to, they're being invalidated, and they're being told that they just need to just get over it.
This is especially disturbing because I think we assume that we live in an era now when there is much more openness and understanding about the reality of mental illness than it was the case even 10 years ago, certainly 20 or 30 years ago. But
yeah.
You're speaking of a very sobering reality. What are the key ingredients in you managing your own mental illness as successfully as you have? I suspect that it has been, in a sense, a combination of different factors that has allowed your recovery to be so complete, so successful. Although, as you recount in your book, there have been certainly some bumps along the way. Chart your recovery for us.
Bumps are an understatement. You know, 7 psych wards in less than 11 years because of suicidal crisis, because I have chronic suicidal thoughts. And so I would say this. First of all, the field itself of brain health and mental health has come very far in the last 10 years. There's no doubt about it that things are changing and the tide is moving in the right direction, and more people are talking about it than ever in an empathetic tone. But that doesn't mean there's so many people out there, kids, young people, adults alike, who are trying to fight their depression or their brain pain, and people are just telling them to move on. That's happening. But I'll tell you this. The things that got me able to stay in recovery as I do every day, even now, because I experience every symptom I've ever experienced on a daily basis, it's just that I'm able to cope with them because I know what they are, how they come, how to fight them, and how to keep going. And there are days when I get suicidal. There are days when I don't see the hope, but I always, always, always tell myself that even though I cannot see the hope, I know for a fact that if I just keep walking, it is there. I will find it. I just need time. That's how I look at it. That's how I look at it today. I do that because I do that routine that was told to me so long ago by Time Magazine and my uncle and my family and my friends and my doctors. You know, Kevin, when you have bipolar disorder, the best thing you can do with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, is live your life on a very strict routine. This helps you stabilize the psychosis and the instability within the brain illness. So that routine consists of eating healthy foods, exercising 5 out of 7 days a week, 23 minutes a day, which leads to 12 hours of better mood. Most people don't know that. 23 minutes of rigorous exercise every day leads to 12 hours of better mood. It's amazing. What if you do that twice a day? 24 hours of better somatic wellness. It's phenomenal. So you can do things like that. You can eat healthy foods that feed your brain's nutritious foods that absolutely help the brain in its regular function. You can make sure that if you're suffering with insomnia or sleep apnea or sleep issues or disorders, you get those checked out and write it, because the sleep you get at night, the 7 to 8 hours most people need to thrive, is crucial for me, for example, to continue going. So you've got that. You've got all kinds of great stuff to do. You have to work for it. You have to find the therapies that fit your lifestyle, as long as they're proven, reputable, and appropriate. Therapy is in itself talk therapy. Education is to your brain disease. If you've been diagnosed, read everything you possibly can about it so you can fight it better. All of these things can help you heal. And if you're doing them simultaneously or every day, you have a much better chance than someone who is not self-aware enough to recognize that they have to work very hard to survive a mental illness. That's the one thing people don't get. Everyone comes to me and they say, what pill did you take? It's not about that. The medication I take helps me. It doesn't help everyone. Everyone's brain is absolutely different. And so I can't tell you my medication because it might hurt you. It might not be right for your system. But what I can do is tell you that with exercise, eating habits properly, sleep habits really intact, education, and so much more, you can find healing within this this battle inside.
Kevin Hines is the author of this fascinating book called Cracked, Not Broken. Before we let you go, say a word about the role that you think your work as an advocate, as an inspirational speaker, traveling the country, as you're going to do in coming to Racine in February. What role you think that has played in your overarching recovery effort? I mean, and at any point, has it been a source of difficulty, or for the most part, has it been only a positive factor in your recovery?
Well, I'll tell you this. It's been an extremely positive factor for the most part in my recovery. Most of the time when I go and I speak and I do work in the field of mental health and I help public awareness campaigns for suicide prevention, and I've actually been doing a lot of film work lately, founded a mental health media company with my wife, Stephanie Montgomery Productions, and we're putting out a documentary next year called Suicide, the Ripple Effect. And it's had one of the most powerful impacts in my life because I get to travel around the world now with the film and meet people who have changed their lives, a lot of them, frankly, because they heard my story, and a lot of them because they heard other people's stories of hope that are helping people heal. So in doing that, I'm finding this catharsis of kindness, of people saying, I was at the worst of my worst, and your story told me that I could stand up, fight this, beat it, and keep going. And with that, you know, I some years ago, I wrote a 10-step guide to the art of living mentally well. Its nascent stages are in the back of my book, but the newest form of it is actually a program being used by people all over the world. And so all of these things combined and my efforts have given me this boost of life-affirming hope that I can't deny. Now, I'll tell you this. There are some days when I go to a speech and I'm in a lot of pain, and have just been overcome with either depression or paranoia, oftentimes paranoia because it's the hardest thing I found to get rid of. And I'm not talking about general paranoia. I'm talking about extreme paranoia where you think everyone in the room is trying to kill you. And when the room is filled with 3,000 people that you're about to speak to, that's going to be hard to get on stage and look at these people with the absolute powerful fear that at any moment they're going to hurt you. And so I tell myself through grounding exercises, Kevin, that's irrational. And I do these things. I look at my hand and I say, Kevin, your hands are real. And they're in everyone's reality. Everyone who's looking at you can see your hand as well as you can. But the paranoid delusions, those are in a distorted reality. And those things can't hurt you. So keep going, keep fighting, and keep moving forward.
An important message indeed from the author of Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. Kevin Hines, thank you so much and very best wishes to you.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear my interview with Kathleen Kelly Janis, author of a very interesting book called Social Startup Success, How the Best Nonprofits Launch, Scale Up, and Make a Difference. It's a very, very interesting book that is not only interesting for the practical advice that it gives for someone wanting to start a nonprofit, but it's also full of really inspiring stories about the work of nonprofits across the country. On Monday, you'll hear my conversation with a history professor who's one of the contributors to the next American Experience documentary called The Gilded Age, which takes a look at that fact.